What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world, not forgetting current events that occur, plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah, Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know, the lawyers in the house.
Welcome to Legal Face Off on WGN Plus. I'm Rich Lenkov, one of your co-hosts. Jason Whiteside is here as well. Jason, say hello to our millions
of
guests.
Hello to everyone
listening
out there.
Today, Sam Panianiewicz is off. We're going to tackle lots of stuff today. We're going to cover food labeling. We're going to cover the Uber of legal aid. We're going to talk about temporary workers' benefits. We're then going to cover the Staples Office Depot merger that was blocked this week, a lawsuit against Sumner Redstone and his competency, the Starbucks iced coffee case, and lots more celebrity lawsuits. But starting off right now, we have Adam Hoflick. Adam is a professor of practice at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. He's also a partner at Bartlett Beck, and he's going to talk to us today about class actions involving food labels. Adam, welcome to Legal Face Off.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what's going on May 26th, if you can.
Sure. The federal courts have a group of lawyers called the Judicial Panel on Multi-District Litigation, and they will be convening here in Chicago to determine whether a group of cases relating to food labeling should be consolidated for pretrial proceedings.
So food label litigation has been on the upswing lately. We've seen lawsuits filed against companies like Trader Joe's alleging that that store is underfilling its 5-ounce cans of tuna and therefore misleading customers. We've seen a suit filed against Quaker Oats alleging that consumers have been misled because their sugar oatmeal does not contain maple syrup, despite the fact that it's called maple and brown sugar. Lots of lawsuits like that. Do you feel that these lawsuits have merit? Do you think that class action lawsuits are the proper avenue for going after these kind of food these types of companies for these kind of allegations?
I can't really speak to the merits of these individual cases. I am skeptical that the class action device is the best method of regulating conduct here. First, I think the FDA has authority to regulate this area, and that both the FDA and the Federal Trade Commission are far better able to regulate and govern here than are the courts. I'm also skeptical that the class action vehicle is the appropriate mechanism for resolving issues like this, including, for example, I think defendants have a due process right to know who is suing them, and I don't think it is possible to ascertain with any sort of objectivity who the people are that are suing. I don't think people have objective proof of who bought, for example, the maple syrup that you're grazing, and I don't think it's possible to determine on a class-wide basis using common proof who was deceived and who wasn't. And I think a defendant has the right to cross-examine the individual people suing them and to have a jury determine whether what they did actually injured that person.
Well,
go ahead.
Oh, Adam, if the class action is not, in your opinion, is not the appropriate vehicle to take care of these matters, what is the process that the FDA would use then if someone says, all right, my maple syrup was, 2 ounces lighter than what I bought, and they make a complaint to the FDA? What's the process that they would go through in order to have the company rectify whatever shortage might be alleged in the product?
And I think we discussed this before we got on the air relating to the Kind health bars. There, what happened was the FDA issued a warning letter relating to a certain aspect of the product's labeling and the marketing of the product. After that, the class actions came, and yesterday the FDA weighed in again. And so the FDA has the ability to make companies stand up and listen without the societal burdens of a class action. which may not be well suited to resolve the issues.
So we're going to cover in a few minutes in our legal grab bag segment one class action against Starbucks that got a lot of attention when it was filed last week. This consumer, on behalf of a class, is alleging that Starbucks put too much ice into iced coffee. I'm sure you heard of that. There are similar examples.
Don't laugh. That's a serious matter.
Right. It's completely laughable. There are similar, in my opinion, laughable cases that have been sued in the food labeling area. There was a lawsuit in 2009 in which a California woman sued PepsiCo. And she alleged that she was misled because Captain Crunch Berry cereal does not contain any real fruit. And a California federal judge, thankfully, threw it out. And he said, I'm going to quote him here because you couldn't write it in a better way than Judge England wrote. He said, the court is not aware of, nor has plaintiff alleged the existence of, any actual fruit referred to as a crunch berry. So far as this court has been made aware, there is no such fruit growing in the wild or occurring naturally in any part of the world. I mean, that says everything. That says everything about how, you know, ridiculous that lawsuit is and how ridiculous some of these class actions are when they're alleging that, you know, these minor details in food labels are affecting their lives. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, it's a loaded question. So, yes, I agree. I think there are places where class actions can be important, effective devices. I'm just skeptical that this is the right place to impose the costs the class actions are accompanied by, as opposed to having the FDA regulate them. I also just don't believe these are cases that can be proved on a class-wide basis using common proof, or the trials involving them would be manageable. You know, take your example of the iced coffee. Even if it were a more serious issue than you're claiming, how would you determine which consumers wanted a lot of ice and which ones didn't? How would you determine who was deceived or who was told by the barista at Starbucks, this is the amount of ice we put in, and if they were asked? So I just don't understand how you would sue a company on behalf of everyone who ever bought that product without the individual inquiries that would dominate actually a fair proceeding on the issue.
Yeah, I mean, as a plaintiff's attorney, Adam, I mean, I obviously, you know, class actions I believe in, and I think you do too. It's just in the right circumstance. The ice, I mean, I don't know, you look at it too, if you got too much, you know, coffee at one point, you know, that, is that a benefit to the person? And then, you know, they say, well, it's 2 ounces too light this time. And I know there were cases, like in the 80s, the Tylenol, that was tainted. I mean, they had a class action for that. There's the same article you were quoted in. There was an article on, General Mills over Cheerios that were tainted with pesticides. That was used as a class action. Is that, in your opinion, are those types of cases appropriate for the class action system?
I mean, I think there are certainly areas where class actions are important and effective vehicles. I don't think we would have had the civil rights progress that we've had, and obviously there's still a long way to go, without class actions. I think they're very important in certain prisoner rights cases. I think they're important in certain types of commercial cases. I'm very skeptical of them in the consumer area, where consumers differ so greatly on what they're purchasing, the reason they're purchasing, and frankly, a lot of consumers, even if given all the information the plaintiffs are complaining about here, would still buy the product. And therefore, those people aren't even injured. So where we've got a situation where you can't really identify who the plaintiffs are because they don't have any proof of purchase, you can't objectively determine who they are, you don't really have a way of giving the defendant the ability to cross-examine the individual plaintiffs on anything from whether they bought the product to what they relied on, or know how individuals were injured. And at the end of the day, you often have plaintiff's lawyers who may receive far greater recoveries than the consumers. I'm skeptical that that's the right area for a class action.
Jason just lit up when you said that. Jason just lit up when you said that, Adam. It was the best thing for him that you said all day. Adam Hoflick, professor of practice at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, and partner at Bartlett Beck. Adam, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Next on Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus, we welcome in Sarah Lieberstein to discuss the rise in temporary workers successfully seeking benefits. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah, you are a senior staff attorney with NELP. NELP is the National Employment Law Project. NELP.org. Tell us about this trend in temporary and part-time workers gaining success in their efforts to recover for their work.
Sure. To start off, there's really nothing new about contingent work. For decades, we've seen employers calling workers independent contractors, even when those workers are really legally employees. And we've also seen employers using abusive subcontracting practices in order to evade all of the legal responsibilities and tax liabilities that they would have for their employees. But we've definitely seen some more high-profile companies like Uber, Lyft, FedEx, you know, claiming that independent contractors are really at the core of their business model. And in turn, especially over the past couple of years, we've seen groups of workers standing up, protesting corporate abuses and attempting to claim a greater share of the profits that their labor is generating. Fast food workers are calling out McDonald's on the abusive labor practices stemming from the corporate business model. Uber and Lyft drivers have taken those companies to court to claim the wages that they would have earned if they were treated as employees. And recently, we've even seen adjunct professors stepping up. There's also a really exciting situation where workers who were employed by a staffing agency to make parts that ultimately went to Ford demanded that the company that ran the plant where they worked hire them on directly instead of subbing out the work, and they won. So I think this is an exciting time, and the landscape is definitely changing.
And Sarah, what criteria is the court system looking for in order to determine if someone should be labeled either an independent contractor or a temporary worker versus a full-time employee that might be, you know, eligible for benefits?
Well, what the court should be looking at, what the guiding question should be in determining at least whether or not a worker is an independent contractor or an employee, is whether the worker is truly in business for him or herself. The courts, and for the purposes of different laws, have for really decades, in many cases since the enactment of basic labor statutes, contemplated joint employment and the difference between independent contractors and employees. So they have slightly different criteria. When they're looking at whether or not a lead company, a bigger corporation like McDonald's, is legally responsible for the workers who might be paid or hired by a franchisee or a subcontractor, they're really looking at whether or not those two companies are both really economically in control over the circumstances that their workers are laboring under. And in a lot of cases, even under legal principles that have been in place for decades, those lead companies could be held on the hook for the labor violations that are committed by a franchisee, a subcontractor, or some outside firm that the corporation is contracting with.
Sarah, you mentioned the Uber situation. Obviously got a lot of news. We covered the recent $100 million settlement on our show extensively. I mean, you're talking about how workers are, you know, gaining some traction, they're gaining some wins. Wasn't that settlement, while certainly an impressive sum of $100 million, wasn't that a win for Uber? And specifically because Uber did not have to agree, or there was no agreement that workers would be classified as employees, which was really the key question in that case.
Right. The legal question is still unresolved. The court did not rule on whether the Uber drivers are employees or independent contractors. And drivers in another jurisdiction could challenge Uber again on that issue or under another law. The workers were able to recoup at least a significant portion of what they would have been owed. And I certainly hope that the workers, either through legal action or better yet through organizing, continue to press for a different model under which they can have more of a say in what's going on at the company and, you know, more economic security and more ability to share in the profits that Uber is making.
You think, obviously, unquestionably, that Uber drivers are, in fact, employees of Uber, right? I take it.
I don't have access to the full set of facts in the case, but from what we've heard, it certainly looks like Uber looks a lot like an employer. It, you know, determines how much is charged to the consumers for a fare, what percent of that the drivers get, whether or not they can even accept tips, let alone ask for them. Uber is in full control of, its technology and determines, how drivers work. And most importantly, and I think something that may have been lost, is that, Uber essentially has the right to suspend and to fire drivers. Its ability to deactivate drivers for not accepting a certain percentage of the fares that come in, or to deactivate drivers based on low customer ratings. By the way, the standard for that is actually not so low overall. So drivers face a pretty high risk of being deactivated, even on the basis of one erroneous poor customer rating. Given those criteria, it looks a lot like Uber is an employer of the drivers, even more so than a traditional taxi company.
You know, and Sarah, as a plaintiff's attorney here in Illinois, we have, the number one criteria that the court always points to is the right to control. And I think you briefly mentioned that with Uber. But from what I see with Uber, they do control the hiring, firing, and, they have to maintain a high rating. But as far as the actual routes that they travel, when they clock in, when they clock out, is that element still missing, right, with these Uber drivers?
Well, I think that Uber and some other on-demand companies really base their argument that the workers are independent business people on the fact that, or their claim that, the workers have flexibility over their work hours. But when we took a closer look at how Uber works in practice, as it turns out, although in theory drivers have flexibility to log in and log out when they want, a lot of that flexibility is illusory. So, for example, there are certain times of the day when driving for Uber just doesn't make economic sense. If it's not a peak time, if surge pricing isn't in effect, a driver who goes out on the road could net below the minimum wage. So the driver may have the flexibility to choose to work during that time, but that flexibility is meaningless in that situation. And once a driver is logged on, they have to accept a pretty high percentage of the fares that come into them. So they really actually don't have that much control over what fares they take. Now, I suppose they can choose to take one street or the next, but that's really true of the way that most of us work. No one's breathing down our neck telling us that we have to work on one memo now and make the phone call later. So to me, that doesn't necessarily signal for sure that the company is not in control of the work.
And
there,
Sarah,
are other
maybe,
ways that Uber... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry to jump in there. It looks like, just from the news release this week out of New York, that maybe Uber is being a little more flexible when it comes to these workers, because in New York, at least, Uber agreed for the first time ever to have an independent guild. You know, you could call it a union. They're not quite using the word union, but there's something called the Independent Drivers Guild that just announced a 5-year agreement with Uber's blessing to represent the 35,000 drivers in New York. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, that's an interesting development. What that says to me is that Uber is definitely feeling the pressure.
Right.
These workers are organizing. It's obviously gotten a lot of bad press over the lawsuits and presumably also, you know, for its recent fight in Austin, where it lost a key vote to be exempt from certain market regulations that apply to all other taxi companies in the city. So it may have responded to that mounting public pressure by giving a nod towards the workers, at least in this limited way.
Sarah Lieberstein, senior staff attorney with the National Employment Law Project. She can be found at NELP.org. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Next on Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus, we welcome in Donna Peel, Executive Director of the Pro Bono Network, and Hina Musabji, the Director of Operations. Thank you for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you for having us.
Tell us what the Pro Bono Network is and why you started it.
Pro Bono Network is a way for attorneys who find volunteering to be very impractical, given their maybe where they live, where they work, maybe their current employment situation. And we provide the infrastructure to make it practical for them. So just taking me, for example, I'm an antitrust lawyer. I know nothing about helping a person. So in order for me to help somebody, I would have to be trained by a legal aid agency and, of course, have clients. And so what we have done is created a way to bring in people like me and get them training at their convenience. And then we match them up to the type of legal aid work they want to do, and we help the legal aid side by providing management assistance and recruitment and finding all the venues to get people trained in.
All right, and let's say that I want to come and volunteer. How would I go about doing that as an attorney? And then also, what type of work would I be working on as a plaintiff's personal injury attorney?
Sure.
You're automatically disqualified. Please tell me he's automatically disqualified.
And I'm not allowed to look for clients while I'm there, right?
As fun as it would be to disqualify you, we actually welcome you. You would actually go onto our website, and there's a little section you can click to join us, and then we have a website that we use as a platform called Meetup. And when you get on there, you will see all the different types of opportunities we have. And our director of programming, Sheila Pont, would connect with you directly and see, you know, what you're interested in, where would be good fits, and kind of introduce you to our over 10 different areas of legal need and get you started.
So what kind of legal practice areas do you service?
Well, currently we have quite a few. We help with orders of protection for victims of domestic violence. We run programs for seniors where we help with powers of attorneys, living wills. We help immigrant victims of violence. Donna, you want to jump in with a few
more? Sure. We go to the Cook County Jail and help incarcerated mothers with their civil legal aid needs. Often this involves things like adoption or guardianship forms, areas where they might need assistance with their family. We do Social Security disability. We can keep going. It really does run the gamut of public interest interests.
Is all this pro bono work done out of, are you guys located in Oak Park?
Our headquarters are in Oak Park, but the work is done usually at a convenience of the attorney's home or in the specific venue. So, for instance, the orders of protection for domestic violence victims is specifically in the Maywood Courthouse, where before us there were no attorneys there volunteering. We also work some help desks, like the expungement help desk downtown with Cabrini Green Legal Aid. And this is probably a good point to mention that we work with legal aid agencies. We work to expand what they're doing because they have waiting lists and very overworked attorneys. There are only about 350 full-time legal aid attorneys to handle the 600,000 people in Cook County who qualify and need legal aid services.
So a lot of the attorneys that work for you or work with you are non-traditional attorneys. By that, I mean people who aren't working 9-to-5 jobs in a law firm or at a corporation, but maybe some people who are working part-time. I know that about 90% of the attorneys in your network are women, many of whom are stay-at-home moms. Is that true?
That is correct. We were actually designed for that experienced stay-at-home attorney mom who wanted to use her valuable law degree to give back, but ran into these obstacles, right? Because you have these obligations that you've, you know, decided not to stay in the traditional practice of law to fulfill, yet there's these barriers to actually being able to give back with your law degree. So we created a system, a very innovative solution, in which we made sure that the projects were available while children were in school. We provided backup by partnering you with another attorney. We provided training either, you know, close to you or online, and malpractice insurance, which is offered through the agency itself. So we kind of make it foolproof and really easy for you to volunteer in that respect. And even though the model was set up for stay-at-home moms, we now kind of have attracted the likes of solo practitioners, retired individuals, other people in the non-traditional practice of law who may not be stay-at-home parents at the moment.
I was also very surprised, pleasantly so, to read in the Forbes article that, by the way, called you or the company the Uber of legal aid. I was surprised to learn that you provide 70% of services for incarcerated mothers in Cook County?
Well, of the pro bono clients for Cabrini Green Legal Aid in the Incarcerated Mothers Program, which is called Chicago Legal Advocacy for Incarcerated Mothers Claim, we provided 70% of the representation in 2015.
What are the type of services that you provide for those clients?
As I said, we go into the jail and find out what that person's family situation is and what they might need. So, for instance, where is your child? They're with my mother. Does your mother have guardianship papers? Often they don't have correct papers set up for their children, or they want advice on whether or not they should go to court to take care of guardianships, or perhaps they are looking for their child. They don't even know where their child is. We help with matters like that.
So those are, you know, big issues, big cases. Life or death matters sometimes. Do you find it difficult to, you know, for example, an attorney who doesn't necessarily deal with that every day, is it difficult for an attorney to make that transition, not just in terms of practice, but even, you know, emotionally, to transition from sort of a more traditional type of law to suddenly being, you know, in Cook County jail and helping someone deal with life or death issues?
Well, I think I'm a perfect example of that person, having been an antitrust lawyer. And then the next thing I know, I'm at the Cook County Jail, and reluctantly so the first time, I might add. There is nothing like, though, helping a client who is enormously grateful. And I'm sure the two of you would agree in your own practice. It's just unbelievable how powerful a law degree is in your ability to problem solve for somebody else. And it gets a little addicting.
Well, I do help people. Rich doesn't. He just represents greedy corporations. But, as far as getting involved, then you said it's easy. You can go to the website and take a look at it, and we can all get involved. And, you know, I know as attorneys we're supposed to, at the end of the year, you always fill out that requirement that we do pro bono work. It would be great to somehow get, you know, the word out about you guys, too, because I don't think anyone knows about it, and it's an easy way to fulfill that pro bono requirement.
Well, let's do that. It's the website is pro-bono-network.org. Folks could visit that, sign up if necessary, if they're interested. Yes.
Yes, correct. No obligation, and you don't get pestered.
Very good. Thank you very much, Donna Peel, Executive Director, and Hina Musabji, Director of Operations for Pro Bono Network. Thank you for joining us on Legal Face Off on WGN Plus.
Thank you for having us.
All right, so. We end off today's Legal Face-Off, as we do every week, with the much-copied but never-duplicated Legal Grab Bag, everyone's favorite segment. We tackle various entertainment, politics, sports issues, all from a legal perspective, all hot issues. Don't forget to listen to Legal Face-Off on iTunes. Search Legal Face-Off. You could also find us on Facebook at Legal Face-Off and follow us at Twitter at the Legal Face-Off. So, Jason, first topic today is the Staples Office Depot merger. This was blocked late Tuesday night by Judge Sullivan in federal court. You might remember that Office Depot and Staples, two of the largest remaining big box retailers dealing with office supplies, probably the only remaining big box retailers that sell office supplies, they had announced a merger. But a year ago, and the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, sued, basically alleging that this would hinder competition, that this was bad for consumers, bad for businesses, as the FTC routinely does. And much to the surprise of many of us, the court, Judge Sullivan, on Tuesday, found in favor of the federal government. The court said that this is an antitrust issue, that this would result in it would serve to hinder competition and hurt consumers. What was really interesting in this case was that the defendants, the two companies involved, Office Depot and Staples, they didn't present any evidence. The CEOs of both companies were actually sitting in court. And the prosecutor made a big deal in his closing, about the fact that there was no testimony from the two CEOs. The defendants, these two companies, thought that their evidence was so strong that they did not need to present a defense, and it turns out that hurts them. Yeah.
Obviously, that wasn't right.
Would you ever, in a closing argument to a jury, or... obviously, before the closing argument, would you ever, in any case, not present any evidence?
No.
I mean, as a plaintiff, that's obviously almost impossible.
Yeah.
As a defendant, sometimes, you would stipulate to issues, and, there's obviously a motion for a directed verdict if you don't think that the other side has proven their case, but...
Yeah, obviously, these CEOs were advised to that they had a strong enough case, so they didn't have to present any evidence. But I don't think that's ever proper to do that. I mean, you can't assume. You and I both know in a court system, you don't know what the outcome is going to be as much as you try to place the odds for your client. But no one can really tell the outcome of the case. And obviously, without presenting any evidence, the judge ruled against the merger, as it would inhibit competition in the free marketplace.
Yeah, so, the government is more aggressive, I think, than ever. We've dealt with that on this show before in going after mergers that they think would create too much of a monopoly. This was a $6.3 billion merger. I guess what the court missed is that a couple things. These two companies... are not doing very well.
Right.
Most people don't shop at big box retailers much anymore, let alone for office supplies. What the court misses is that Amazon dominates this marketplace.
Is that going to do to competition if both of these companies go out of business?
Right.
It's on the verge of doing so.
Yeah, I mean, other mergers that the government has successfully shut down, in addition to this Office Depot Staples one, Sysco U.S. Foods. Sysco is, we've got two food distribution companies. U.S. Foods is a local company here in Rosemont. That merger failed because a similar argument was presented successfully by the federal government. AT&T, T-Mobile, Comcast, Time Warner. So in my opinion, I think it's better for the free market to rule. And, the government shouldn't be shutting these things down. If the market doesn't support this kind of merger, then, you know, the consumers would say so.
Yeah, in the industry I always love watching, too, is the airline industry, because that has shrunk. But over the last 5 to 7 years, it shrunk exponentially. And I think, I mean, you can see the prices. I mean, you and I both fly enough, and you can see the prices increasing, too, of tickets now. So I don't know why that market always gets a pass, but Virgin America was just merged with another company. Richard Branson was sad to see it go.
Yeah, Alaska Airlines.
Yeah. So there's another merger where it's two airlines, now there's one. So that industry keeps shrinking to where, I mean, you know, there's only a handful of players now that are the main common carriers.
Yeah,
in
I think four airlines take up about, you know, 80% of the market. Next story, Sumner Redstone. There was a competency case that was dismissed pretty abruptly last week by a judge. The
Get this. Imagine this. His former mistress or former girlfriend, who's about 50 years younger than he is, was named as the administrator of his estate. Well, not of his estate, but was named as the administrator of his affairs. And then he had her removed, and so she filed in November a lawsuit claiming that Mr. Redstone's daughter and son were driving her out. And so there was a competency hearing, and it took the judge about 18 minutes of testimony from Summer Redstone to determine he was in full competency and capable to make his own decisions when he determined that Manuela was not supposed to be in charge of his affairs anymore.
Yeah, Sumner Redstone. Sorry, go ahead.
No, she promptly filed a lawsuit within minutes later against Miss Redstone, who's Sumner's daughter, and her adult sons, Tyler and Brandoff, in the amount of $100 million, and then listed a team of nurses and other employees of Mr. Redstone, who is worth, what was it, $42 billion?
Yeah, $42 billion. He is 92 years old. Sumner Redstone, of course, is head of Viacom and CBS. A couple interesting, you know, side notes were, was the key testimony was this video that he presented. He didn't appear live in court. He presented via a video deposition, and that was really the crux of the entire case as to whether that showed him incompetent. Certainly, the video hasn't been released, but the transcript has been released, but by all accounts, the video definitely shows him frail, definitely shows him having difficulty communicating, and you know,
yeah,
some
he couldn't he couldn't spell his own name, or he couldn't state what his full name was, but he did definitely, the transcript says, he denigrated Manuela Herzer and called her several obscenities multiple times, and that he hated her and wanted her out of his life.
Yeah,
I think that's pretty clear.
Asking for part of your $42 billion
yeah.
will have that effect.
Yeah.
Yes, I now hate her.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, both parties agree. I mean, Redstone's attorneys weren't disagreeing that he had difficulty communicating, but they were saying that was just basically difficulty talking.
Yeah.
The plaintiff said that that was an example of him being incompetent. The interesting side note is that is the question of how this will affect his standing with the company. I mean, he already had his salary reduced by Viacom. He's just really a figurehead at 92 years old.
Yeah.
He's not really, you know, involved in the day-to-day affairs, but he still holds, you know, this title and still holds a place on the board. So probably will affect his standing with the company.
Yeah, they did note that he had some early onset dementia, which is not unusual for 92 years old. But it's interesting that with all these cases revolve around millions and millions of dollars, which is a lesson that if you don't have money, you don't have to worry about this.
True enough, the evils of money. Next story that we covered, we haven't covered on this show, but it's been on the news pretty extensively, even though it's only about a week old, is the Starbucks iced coffee lawsuit.
I'm drinking one right now.
You're the ones, of course, supporting a lawsuit because
right.
iced coffee, guess what, has ice.
You know what I do? This is a trick, everyone. I order it with light ice,
ah.
So it's less ice and more coffee.
So you're saying it is possible to say the words light ice
yeah.
and not suffer these irreparable damages
yeah,
that
but,
this
you know,
plaintiff suffered.
With Starbucks, though, you need to know their terminology. You know, the first time it was embarrassing. I asked for less ice, and they said, no, you mean light ice. I was like, oh, okay.
Who would ever think that an iced coffee would have ice? This, of course, is a lawsuit filed by Stacy Pinkus here in Chicago in the federal Northern Illinois Federal Court, Northern District of Illinois, I should say. Pinkus alleges that Starbucks customers are being misled because Starbucks iced drinks contain just over half of the liquid they think they are paying for. The complaint says that when you order a 24 fluid ounce cup of Starbucks iced coffee, you're only actually getting 14 fluid ounces of that drink. just over half of the advertised amount, and the balance of which is ice. Of course, it begs the question, is ice a liquid? Is ice a fluid? Is it part of a drink? I, of course, think that this lawsuit is ridiculous. It's a class action suit, right? So as we've covered on this show before, the real beneficiaries to this class action will not be the customers who receive a couple of drink coupons. It'll be
rather
the attorneys.
The hardworking plaintiff's attorneys go after these vicious corporate entities.
Right. So received a lot of notoriety, which is probably one of the goals of this type of lawsuit. Starbucks, of course, is denying liability, rightfully so, in my opinion, and they're dismissing this as a frivolous lawsuit.
Well, they're comparing it, too, to the Subway lawsuit where they weren't a full 12 inches in their feet. So Subway now corrected that.
Yes, much to the delight of
Jared Fogle.
Subway lovers worldwide. Next story is a Snapchat accident. There was a driver who was involved in an accident while Snapchatting, and what happened?
Well, there's an app apparently with Snapchat that it can judge the speed with which you're driving the vehicle. So a girl, a teenager, had her vehicle at 107 miles per hour when she crashed into another car, and she was trying to gauge the speed of her vehicle on a Snapchat app. So Snapchat has been named in a lawsuit for encouraging this type of behavior. Unfortunately, the other driver, Mr. Maynard, suffered a pretty severe brain injury as a result. So they've instituted a lawsuit against Snapchat for this app encouraging people to drive at a high rate of speed. Snapchat has denied liability, saying that they don't offer any trophies for first place if someone reaches a certain speed in the app. So it'll be interesting. I think some of this comes back to a little user responsibility, not using your phone while you're driving a car at 107 miles per hour.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things. Snapchat does say that the app, or the filter more specifically, warns against do not snap and drive. But on the other hand, how are you supposed to use this filter, which is meant to tell your Snapchat friends, whatever the term is, how fast you're driving without driving fast?
Yeah.
It seems a little...
It's not made for running.
It seems a little backwards, yeah, to say that the whole point of the filter is to show people how fast you're driving, yet you're not supposed to use it while driving.
What I love is that the individual who caused this accident took a picture of herself, a nice selfie, or one of her friends took it, and it says, lucky to be alive while she's strapped to a gurney with blood dripping down her forehead.
There's never a wrong time to take a selfie is the lesson there.
Yeah.
Even when you have a traumatic brain injury strapped to a gurney.
Nothing like documenting the fault of the accident and the cause of it all in one.
Right. But, you know, with developing technology like Snapchat, like Facebook, like Uber, we've talked, you know, before, plaintiffs will seek to sue bigger corporations. I mean, that goes back as long as people have been suing each other. But in this case, not only going after the individual who caused the accident, but the other driver is going to go after Snapchat because they have deep pockets.
Yeah, and at some point in time, too, I mean, when, you know, cars are, I mean, there's all this development right now with driverless cars, and hopefully at some point in time there will be technology initiated that can eliminate the use of the cell phone, or at least, you know, the extent of it while you're actually operating the car. Maybe disable apps, something of that type.
Did you see the new Alanis Morissette update on Ironic? She was on the James Corden show a couple nights ago, and you know her song Ironic.
Yeah.
So they updated that with all modern technology. So she talks about Uber and Waze and Facebook, and
still milking that song, huh?
Still milking. And fellow Canadian, love the. Alanis, next we move to some celebrity lawsuits. Always our favorite part of Legal Face
Off. Busta Rhymes.
Busta Rhymes. We have a favorite Busta Rhymes song over there? Mike?
No.
Favorite one? Is it maybe Twerk It? So Busta Rhymes is hit with a lawsuit over what is being called his ageism. A former driver is suing Busta Rhymes for using ageist remarks over the 2 years that he drove him from Busta Rhymes' Brooklyn apartment to clubs throughout the city. According to the complaint, Busta Rhymes said things like, "You drive like an old man." He would yell this to his driver, who is 57 years old. Rhymes is 44 years old. When this driver would refuse to gun it through red lights and obey the speed limit, Busta Rhymes, whose real name, by the way, is Trevor Smith, would say things like, "You're driving your age." I could see that. He would berate him. He said that he acted like an old man, according to this lawsuit, which was filed in Brooklyn federal court earlier this week. And the plaintiff says that these were intentionally hurtful and upset the plaintiff and injured his feelings. Busta Rhymes' attorney came back and said, you know, basically, wah, 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 that people get called names all the time, and that this is something that you should just deal with.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a wage lawsuit, that's one thing. I mean, that's every Department of Labor for the state has a law in the books that get your wages paid. But the his hurt feelings, I don't know how you compensate for that. It's kind of funny, but I guess anyone that's working for Busta Rhymes can expect some sort of that attitude out of it.
Next story is another Canadian in the news. In addition
you
to
Canadians,
Alanis Morissette,
this is making news everywhere.
Canadian news on Legal Faceoff. We have Justin Bieber in trouble again. Is this? Should we just run a loop from our prior Legal Faceoff shows from prior grab bags?
Does Justin Bieber need an attorney, Rich? We should just go be his legal
not
team.
Bad,
I mean,
yeah,
it would be busy all the
gig.
Time.
Not a bad gig.
Yeah, he's now getting sued by a guy who says that Justin Bieber destroyed his cell phone, and he wants $100,000 in compensation. That's what he's asking the court to award. Apparently, he was at a nightclub in Houston when Justin Bieber showed up and began playing around, and then he acted like he was going to extinguish a cigarette on the rapper's arm. Somehow, Bieber grabbed a beer pong, tried to chug it, and spilled it all over his clothes and his face. And so Morgan was shooting a cell phone video at the time of the mishap, and Justin Bieber came enraged, grabbed his cell phone, and smashed it to pieces. So Morgan never got his SIM card back, which contained precious memories, pictures of his grandma's birthday party.
Grammy.
Yeah, everyone needs those pictures from Gammy. And he lost business contacts, so that somehow is adding up to
$100,000. What do you mean somehow? Don't use the word somehow. I thought you'd say only $100,000.
That's what I meant by somehow.
Yeah, it's got to be worth a lot more than $100,000.
Precious memories of grandma?
Gammy has got to be worth a lot more than $100,000. Yeah. Finally, on Legal Faceoff, we finish off with Arsenio Hall suing Sinead O'Connor. Sinead O'Connor said on Facebook, she posted a Facebook rant alleging that Arsenio Hall supplied Prince with illegal hard drugs over a decade. O'Connor wrote that two words for the DEA investigating where Prince got his drugs, Arsenio Hall. She said, anyone imagining Prince was not a longtime hard drug user is living in cloud cuckoo land, which I think is a reference to maybe Wreck-It, not Wreck-It Ralph, but maybe Wreck-It Ralph. I got to check with my animation on that. But she said, Arsenio, I've reported you to the sheriff's office. Well, Arsenio Hall shot back through his lawyers, said the malicious statements are absolutely false, and O'Connor's heinous accusations are despicable, fabricated lies. He said he's had no contact with O'Connor, has not seen her in 25 years. Of course, denies supplying drugs to Prince. You know who the real winner is in this lawsuit, Jason?
Who?
The 90s. Because yeah. Arsenio
Hall
and
it all back.
Sinead O'Connor.
I feel like this is high school all over again.
Brings me back to
1992. Does Arsenio even live near Prince? Does he live in Minneapolis, or is he even close to him?
I think Arsenio is everywhere. He's omnipresent. Yeah. his drug reach is everywhere. But
you know what I love too is what did you read Gene Simmons' article on Prince?
I saw some headline. I didn't read it though.
Yeah, it was just denigrating Prince for falling to the cliche of every rock and roll star of you know, dying from drug overdose or alcoholism.
Yeah.
But then Gene Simmons claimed he's never drank and he's never done any sort of recreational drug ever. And he followed it up with, I don't know if anyone's going to believe me or not, but it's the truth.
And I'm selling a Kiss coffin and a Kiss cruise. And
please meet me in Vegas for my signing of all Kiss memorabilia.
Yes, that brings us to the conclusion of another action-packed, award-winning episode of Legal Faceoff on WGN+. We made it through an episode without our trusty host, Sam Panianovich. Sam, get well soon.
We miss you.
We miss you, Sam. Thanks to our trusty producer, Mike. See you next time on Legal Faceoff on WGN+.
content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.